Federal immigration authorities have tried to access Illinois' driver's license photos. Today, we speak with the Illinois Secretary of State's office about why they've said no to that request. Plus, Illinois Democrats have drawn our state's election map for years. They'll probably get another chance after the 2020 census. Governor J.B. Pritzker has said he'll veto any unfair maps, but would he do it if it led to a smaller majority? And two decades ago, hundreds of life-size cow sculptures in Chicago ignited a worldwide interest in public art. Now, more than a dozen are back in the city for the month of July.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, we're going to bring you the latest on Illinois immigration news. While it doesn't seem as if President Trump's announced plans to round up undocumented immigrant families over the weekend actually happened, what did happen was thousands of people turning out in downtown Chicago to protest these policies. We're also going to speak with the Illinois Secretary of State's office about its decision not to comply with federal requests to mine our driver's license database. But first, Democrats have controlled both chambers of the state legislature since 2003. In the House, they've held the majority for 36 of the past 40 years. And of course, for much of that time, they've been led by Speaker Michael Madigan. This has given the party control of not just the legislative agenda, but our state's electoral map. Illinois politicians have been talking about the issue of fair election maps for years, including back in 2016 when then-President Barack Obama addressed the State House, the General Assembly, in Springfield.
Second step towards a better politics is rethinking the way that we draw our congressional districts. Now, let me point this up. I want to point this out because this is another case of cherry picking here. This tends to be popular in states where Democrats have been drawing the lines among Republicans, and less popular among Republicans where they control drawing the lines. So nobody's, let's be very clear here. Nobody's got clean hands on this thing. Fact is, today technology allows parties in power to precision draw constituencies so that the opposition supporters are packed into as few districts as possible. That's why our districts are shaped like earmuffs or spaghetti. It's also how one party can get more seats even when it gets fewer votes.
That audio courtesy of the Obama White House. So that was back in 2016, when there was also an attempt to take this issue to Illinois voters. Thanks to a ruling by the Supreme Court late last month, in Illinois, Democrats are going to continue to control that map in the future, including after the next census. To explain more on this, I'm joined now by Chris Mooney, professor of state politics at UIC and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Rick Pearson is a Chicago Tribune political reporter and host of the Sunday Spin on WGN. Guys, welcome to the 21st. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chris, so every state has control over its own maps. And as former President Obama was saying, there's no party that is blameless here. And I wonder how this looks like, gerrymandering looks like in Illinois compared with some other high profile examples we've seen, like Wisconsin or North Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, the ex-president there, Obama, had it the nail right on the head. This is pure politics. It's nothing to do with ideology. It's nothing to do with partisanship. It's, you know, them that's got gets. And so if you're in power, this is the way you keep power. And that's all it's about. And both parties, again, are to blame for it. It just so happened that the Democrats nationally are much more put upon by this whole thing than they are in Illinois, because in the current congressional and state legislative maps, for the most part, were drawn based on the 2010 census. And they were drawn in 2011, with legislative chambers and governor's offices who were just coming off the big Tea Party sweep in 2010, where we had more state more Republican state legislatures, state legislative seats held than any time since Herbert Hoover was on office. And so you get places like Wisconsin, like Pennsylvania, like North Carolina, where, you know, they really take this to the nth degree, like they have here with technology. And, you know, they're able to, I think, you know, they'll, you know, win 67% of the seats with 48% of the vote, that kind of thing.
And Chris, as you're alluding to, Rick, I wonder if you can, as Chris is alluding to, Rick, I wonder if you can explain a little bit more. Some people might think electoral maps, why does this matter?
Well, it matters a great deal because obviously it impacts the makeup of your General Assembly. It makes up the representation that you have in Congress. You know, it basically proves to dictate what the policy of the state is going to be. And that's kind of the ultimate control factor is, as Chris said, you know, those who have the power, they get. And so, you know, there are complicating factors here that the Supreme Court basically punted on this and said that this is not a factual matter. It's a political matter, and that the states have mechanisms on their own to deal with what they may perceive as overtly partisan maps. And it basically comes down to politicians drawing maps to support keeping them in office rather than drawing maps that would allow for more opportunity for different candidates from different parties to kind of fairly compete.
And so, Chris, as Rick's talking about that Supreme Court case, that ruling from last month, that means essentially then the power to draw maps stays with states? That's what the Supreme Court ruling means?
Well, the power to draw maps is always, I mean, with the states. Almost every single regulation or rule having to do with elections is a reserved power for the state, and the states control all that stuff. I mean, the Supreme Court from time to time will say, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that, because it's violating some other principle in the Constitution. For example, in the early 60s, when they said, look, there were some cases brought, for example, in Tennessee, where you had districts that were widely different in size. You know, one district might, you know, have 1,000 people, another has 12,000 people. Clearly, they're not getting the same representation. And the courts stayed out of that for decades. Until the early 60s, they then decided, look, this is too crazy. This is violating equal protection under law. And so every district now has to be more or less equal within a given legislative chamber. And that's a principle we abide by and have abided by, you know, for 60 years now. So it is possible that the Supreme Court could have changed their mind on this political thing, because they've always said politics, you know, this is a political thing. You can't do it. You can't gerrymander to keep, you know, racial groups suppressed and that sort of thing. But party, that's fair game. They could have changed that this time, but they didn't.
Mm-hmm. And so when we think about how this looks, Rick, I wonder, we heard President Obama mention a couple times like districts that look like earmuffs or spaghetti. When you look at a map, for example, in Illinois, Rick, where would you see kind of this weird gerrymandering happening?
Well, first, and there's another protection, too, about courts, and that's also Voting Rights Act issues. And Chris mentioned about, you know, trying to draw lines to disenfranchise minority community. But the courts have been open to drawing maps to help empower minority communities. So you heard the former president talk about the earmuff or the cloth. He's referring what's known as Illinois' 4th Congressional District, the one now held by Chuy Garcia, which basically was drawn to try to unite two geographically separate areas of Latino voters in an effort to empower them to be able to elect a Latino congressman in the state. But it literally looks like a C. It looks like a claw. And it's actually connects these two geographically separate communities mainly by using a Chicago Expressway, where there's no voters along that expressway.
Right. But in that case, though, Rick, the courts have said that's important because it makes it more fair.
That's right. Then you take a look at example of the Illinois 5th Congressional District, which is Mike Quigley, Democrat, which goes from the lakefront, basically the lakefront and Wrigley Field, and stretches west, cuts down a bit south, again using an expressway, and cuts into DuPage County, a traditional Republican area, and takes in parts of Elmhurst, which is a heavily traditional Republican area. And it's now represented by a Democratic congressman from the lakefront.
And right. So to your, Chris, that is a clear example of Democratic gerrymandering in terms of making that district, ensuring that that district stays Democratic, correct?
Well, and not only ensuring that the district stays Democratic, but the key thing on gerrymandering is to maximize your votes, minimize the opponent's votes. So what Rick just said is that they've got plenty of Democrats over here in Wrigleyville, so now we're going to go find some Republicans over in Elmhurst and we're going to waste
and we can
their
outvote
vote,
them, right.
Right, they're going to, 40% of the district will be Republican or something, and so but the Democrats will always win. And then on the other side of the coin, what you do is you take your opponents, they're going to win some districts, and you cram them all into the same district. So in districts that your party wins, you're winning by 55-65%. In districts that your opponent's winning in, they're winning by 95-100%. So that's how you're wasting their votes. And if you really want to look at some crazy districts, the congressional districts, Rick is right. There's some wacky ones there. And the ones in 2000, the last map we had in Congress, there was some really nutty stuff there. Like the worst, most egregious case of congressional redistricting I've ever seen. But look at the House districts, the state House districts, because then you're getting much smaller districts. And if you look around in the northeast part of the state, around the Chicagoland area, there's a lot of them that are just like really long and skinny, or, they're winding around and they're going all over the place.
Right, and, like former Juliana Stratton's district, right, that used to be Ken Duncan's mm-hmm. seat. That one was a really tiny, like, windy down from, I remember Representative Duncan used to say to me, I represent the Gold Coast, the Soul Coast, and it was his
exactly
description
right.
of within Chicago. Rick, so when
about 100 blocks.
Yeah.
100 blocks long and about 3
in
blocks
Chicago,
long.
Which is So Rick, when we say that the Democratic Party in Illinois has had control over the election maps, does that basically mean that Speaker Michael Madigan has had control over these maps?
That's basically the truth. And one thing to keep in mind too about Madigan is that in drawing those legislative districts, as well as with the congressional, but primarily with the legislative districts, I referenced Mike Quigley in Congress reaching out to traditionally Republican areas like DuPage County. But by controlling the legislative map, this has allowed Democrats to make significant inroads in the state legislature in traditionally Republican areas as well, including DuPage County. And so it's maximizing that Democratic strength while trying to weaken and disperse the Republican strength in these suburban areas, which is, a major feat for Madigan and for Democrats. I mean, I remember back decades ago, the first thing you would check when redistricting was coming up was to see how much money each of the Republican and Democratic caucuses in the state were allocating for computer resources for the punch card system to try to draw these maps. And now, if you've got a laptop, you can download the data and you can draw highly efficient, highly targeted maps to even, draw out an incumbent and put him into a completely separate district that he or she has no real attachment to.
That's a Chicago Tribune sub, Rick Pearson. Sorry, Chris, I just wanted to ask you, go ahead, Chris, finish your thought, and then I wanted to ask you another question.
I was just going to say that's really one of the problems these days. I mean, they've been doing gerrymandering for a couple hundred years. In fact, the word gerrymandering is
comes from Elbridge Gerry.
Elbridge Gerry, right.
I played him in the Continental Congress in fourth grade. That's why I remember that.
Very good, yes. And you said it right. It's not Eldridge. It's Elbridge, which is odd. But anyway, we've been doing it forever. And the difference is now we have the technology and we have the data to make them extremely precise. Back in the 70s, there's a famous story about a guy, a California Politico, who drew out the House districts for California in the back of an envelope on a train. And And that's the kind of thing they used to do. But now it is super high tech. It's down to the, you know, they really can identify where people are given the data we've got. And it just makes it more difficult for representation to occur in a sort of objective fashion.
So we're almost out of time, but Chris, the big question is now what Governor Pritzker has said about this gerrymandering. We have super majorities in both chambers, but what has Governor Pritzker said about this issue?
Well, he's a big fair map guy. He's been pushing that. He's a goo-goo from the North Shore, so that's what they do. Now, when push comes to shove, I will be very shocked if he goes toe-to-toe with Mike Madigan on this, because this is the most important thing for Mike Madigan and the party establishment in a decade. It always is. If Pritzker is going to get other things done, all the things that he wants to do, this would be a battle I think he would probably not want to take on and probably lose if he did.
Rick, do you imagine this would be the biggest battle between Governor Pritzker and Speaker Madigan if there was one?
It could be, but I agree with Chris. This is not necessarily a battle that I think Governor Pritzker wants to take on. He said during the campaign, and his campaign or his office has repeated that he believes in fair maps, and that if he gets sent a gerrymandered map that's too partisan, if he gets sent to that by the Democrats who control the legislature, he would veto it. I'd express some serious doubts that that really will be the case. I don't think this is the battle to pick if you're a new governor, particularly when you have so much on your agenda still to try to accomplish in the General Assembly.
And it's a spin issue, too. It's not a black and white thing. The Democrats say it's a fair map. The Republicans say it's not a fair map, you know.
Yeah, so we will see how this issue continues to play out. I want to thank Chris Mooney with UIC, Rick Pearson with the Chicago Tribune. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. For weeks, the Trump administration has said they would step up raids in some cities to take undocumented immigrant families into custody for deportation. Raids in cities all over the country, including Chicago, were planned for yesterday, but it's unclear how many arrests were actually carried out. And at this point, it doesn't appear that there were mass raids that President Trump originally announced. Still, the threat of those raids brought thousands of people in Chicago out to protest, including in front of Chicago's Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office. Thanks to Chicago independent journalist Aaron Sinek for that audio. When we hear about ICE raids, we often think about officers arriving at someone's house. Certainly, that's a big part of what brought those thousands out in Chicago on Saturday. But there's another way that ICE has been searching for people. Reporting earlier this month from the Washington Post, they found that between 2014 and 2017, ICE tried to sift through millions of driver's license photos in several states using facial recognition technology. Just a small number of states complied with ICE's request to make that data available. Here in Illinois, the Secretary of State's office did not. They said no. Here to talk about why that decision was made is Dave Drucker, a spokesperson for Illinois Secretary of State Jesse White's office. Also joining us to talk more about the implications of facial recognition technology being used by ICE and other law enforcement agencies is Adam Schwartz, a senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, that's a nonprofit that advocates for user privacy and technology. Adam, Dave, thank you for joining us on the 21st. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Dave, I wonder if I can start with you, and I wonder if you can just explain what sort of information ICE requested access to from Illinois. And
sure. First of all, Nyla, it's an honor to be with you and your distinguished audience. So I look forward to our discussion here. The fact is that we do not provide information to not only the feds, but any agency on people's status in the country. We had maybe a half dozen cases in the last several years that agencies have asked us to give them information, and anything pertaining to a status was denied.
And just to back up and remind people, Dave, just to remind people, the reason you would have that is because Illinois is a state that allows people who are undocumented to have identification. So that's how you'd have that, right?
Yes, absolutely. The fact is that what had occurred was is that in 2013, then Governor Quinn had signed legislation that Secretary White strongly supported, allowing people that are undocumented to be able to get a temporary visitor's driver's license. And as part of the process, we assured the immigrant community that those records would be treated the same as anyone else's driving driver's license. And so, you know, those people are protected by the Driver Privacy Protection Act, and status is not something that would qualify to give information on somebody.
And so there's an actual law in Illinois, and that's the basis of why Secretary White rejected these requests.
Well, actually not. Secretary White made that initiative on his own as a commitment to the immigration community. The fact is, we do recognize if they're down the road when there will be another Secretary of State, they might interpret it differently or take another position. So we are going to work to get a law passed to that effect, if not the veto session, definitely by the spring session of the General Assembly.
And how does this work, Dave? How often does ICE? You said there were several requests, so does this?
Yeah, I think in a couple of years, it's been maybe not half a dozen, maybe at the most, and it wasn't just ICE. I believe Homeland Security had made a request as well.
And so they're looking for specific people, or they're asking for requests to the database?
Well, I think in this case, they were looking for specific people. But again, if the standard is the legal status, that's not an acceptable consideration.
What things would be acceptable?
Oh, if somebody was being looked at as a potential terrorist or was being involved as having done something or a violent crime, murder or rape, something of that nature.
So those things, you do comply with those requests?
Yes.
Okay. Adam, so I think when people hear facial recognition, I mean, I always think about how it works in the movies, frankly. You know, you think about Jason Bourne movies where government agencies are scanning and they find matches and find people. In real life, does the actual technology work that well?
Yeah, the face surveillance is perhaps the greatest emerging threat to individual privacy in our country. We are definitely hurtling towards a future that looks like Minority Report, where you walk down the street and governments and corporations are using a unique identifier that you show the world, your own face, in order to figure out who you are and treat you as a criminal suspect. And the time really is now to place restraints on this. We think it is very, very good news that the Illinois Secretary of State has taken the approach that they have taken, which is to not share information from their driver's license photograph database with Immigration and Customs Enforcement and any other agency who is doing immigration checks. So thank you very much to the Secretary of State of Illinois for that. However,
thank you, sir.
From the perspective of EFF, we really don't think government should be in this game at all. We commend San Francisco and Somerville, Massachusetts, which have just banned their police and other agencies from using face surveillance. We wish that the Secretary of State of Illinois would go to the next step, which would be to not share these faces with law enforcement in general.
Adam, but first to the point just about how does this work, facial recognition software, just in terms of how is the technology reliable?
Yeah, I think at this point, the technology has mixed reliability. There's data, for example, from the FBI that suggests that they're in the vicinity of 85 to 95% accurate, meaning, of course, that there are tremendous numbers of false positives. So you could have a situation where someone's face goes in, a suspect comes out, but it's the wrong person, and that misidentified person has their life turned upside down as the government comes and investigates them or arrests them or whatnot. A piece of this, unfortunately, is that the false positive rate is far higher for people of color and for women. Now, we do think that over time, the accuracy will improve and these disparities might disappear, but you still will have a racial disparity, which is that mugshot databases in the country are over full of people of color because of continuing racism in our criminal justice system. And so even when the accuracy problem is solved, there will continue to be a racially disparate impact of law enforcement use of face surveillance.
So, Adam, I wonder if you see or if the Electronic Frontier Foundation sees any advantage to this technology if it were used correctly.
So we do not object to private sector use of face surveillance when the individual who is being surveilled consents. And so we commend Illinois for having the best law in the country on private sector use of face surveillance, which is the Illinois Biometric Information Privacy Act, which says you can consent to someone using your face in their face recognition technology, but they can't do it to you unless you consent. And that's where we think it should be with private sector use. As to government use, we have become so alarmed with the Orwellian ramifications of face surveillance that we think government should be getting out of this business entirely, which again is exactly what San Francisco and Somerville, Massachusetts did last month. And we commend them, and we hope that Illinois cities and the state of Illinois do the same thing.
It's Adam Schwartz.
Go ahead, Dave. I'd be able to respond.
Of course.
To Adam. Mm-hmm. First of all, thank you very much for your comments about our approach to dealing with this. I just would wanted to clarify how we use facial recognition at the Secretary of State's office. It really is the vast majority of it is for internal use. Our purpose is to eliminate fake driver's licenses, fake IDs, and that sort of thing. You potentially have scenarios where people, have a couple DUIs and should not be driving. And when they get stopped by the police officer, they'll give a fake name or a different middle initial or a different identifier. And sometimes you're encountering in the system, people who should not be out on the roads, with 2 and 3 driver's licenses. So part of our purpose here with facial recognition is to eliminate that and to reduce that. And in terms of the fake IDs, people potentially committing identity theft. So that's our purpose, in using it. But we're certainly sensitive to the criticism of the issue in terms of using it and the technology. And, we're always looking at ways to refine and improve the system.
That's Dave Drucker, a spokesperson for the Illinois Secretary of State's office. Dave, to Adam's point, Adam Schwartz, who I should mention used to be based here in Illinois with the ACLU, now with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Dave, to Adam's point, would Secretary White be willing to think about laws along the lines of what has happened in certain municipalities in California, banning facial recognition altogether?
Well, I don't know if we can, go that far. I think, certainly we'd want to hear the criticisms, and we're certainly aware intellectually of the critique of facial recognition. I have to say, though, it's been quite successful for the manner that we use it in.
And back to our initial part of what prompted this conversation, which is ICE using facial recognition and asking states to have access to their database. Again, this did not happen here in Illinois. It did happen.
Yeah, and
in
if I could just add, Nyla, mm-hmm. the way it would work is that if ICE or somebody has a case that they're looking at somebody, again, for a serious issue, they would get the one picture. They wouldn't have complete access to the database and look for lookalikes or other people that they think may be undocumented.
So who does it then? Do you guys do that then? You do the facial recognition and you turn the information over to ICE?
Yes.
I see. That's how it would work. Now,
yes.
When we're...
I just wanted to reassure your audience, people from law enforcement don't have total access to the database and run through it looking for pictures of people.
Well, and as you're thinking about this, just this whole notion of understanding and people being educated about this, people who've seen this story, I wonder if you worry that thinking about stories about this, of ICE requesting this information, will this deter immigrants who are undocumented from seeking a license to begin with?
The original concept, going back to 2012 and then 2013 when the first temporary licenses were issued to undocumented citizens, is that we wanted to reassure people for road safety purposes. We wanted this bill passed and we wanted people signing up. It serves two purposes at a minimum that I'm aware of. One is that the people are being tested so that they know how to drive, which wouldn't be necessarily the case, without the license. And the other thing is that they need insurance when they come in for the testing. So you wouldn't have situations where people get in crashes and, have no coverage. So, we strongly wanted this. At that point in time, when we made this commitment to the undocumented community, to the immigrant community, I think the idea of what this administration is doing now just didn't exist. So, you know, the environment has changed drastically.
And but my question is, I wonder if you worry now that this environment has deterred people.
You know, I'd have to look at the statistics. I don't think that's been the case yet. I think people like the program and are participating, and I don't have a sense, to say I feel uncomfortable trying to respond in terms of how the community feels about it.
And Adam, and when it comes to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, one last question to you. I think people might be aware of Illinois' biometric laws, and again, that relates to private companies, not the government. What would privacy advocates such as your organization like to see happen legally with government access to this?
Yeah, again, number one, we want to see exactly what the Illinois Secretary of State has done, which is to say we're not going to hand information over to the federal government for purposes of identifying people who have broken the immigration laws. And so very much we thank the Illinois Secretary of State for that. And we understand that, you know, abolition of government use of face surveillance might be not what the Illinois Secretary of State is going to agree to, you know, on this phone call. There are some things that we would hope that the Illinois Secretary of State does in connection with face surveillance. The first is that they not allow access to their photo database to other government agencies absent authorization from the state of Illinois. You know, across the country, state DMVs are doing this without legislative authorization. Number two, we think that it's great, as the Secretary of State has just said, that they seem to be limiting it to serious violent crime. I would hope that that is reflected in writing. Number three, we would hope that the predicate for sharing information on these one-offs for serious violent crime is a warrant from a judge, the same as many Illinois government bodies have been saying to ICE. You know, your detainer from an individual, employee isn't good enough. We want a warrant from a judge based on probable cause. And we think that should be the standard before the Illinois Secretary of State allows other law enforcement agencies or ICE to get their license photos, again, based on a probable cause warrant.
Right. Lots to think about here, certainly. Adam Schwartz is a senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I want to thank Dave Drucker for joining us as well, a spokesperson for Illinois Secretary of State Jesse White's office. Dave, Adam, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Getting divorced can be a long and stressful process with lots of emotion and lots of paperwork and lots of hard decisions to make, like money or custody of children. But then there's also the name, what to do with your last name. And for women, if they took their husband's name, they may either want to keep it or change it back after a divorce. But there's lots of steps involved here. Kate Thayer is a features reporter with the Chicago Tribune and joins us now. Hi, Kate. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Kate, it seems that in many cases, women are required to do something that feels pretty old-fashioned, which is announce their name change in a local newspaper?
Yes. So the way the law stood before is if you're changing your name, unless you have otherwise stipulated in a divorce decree, you have to go through, you know, the proper channels to change your name back to your maiden name, which means one of those old school announcements in the newspaper, which costs money and you have to run it several times. And some women thought that this was sort of, you know, airing a private matter in a very public way.
Also, we should add something men don't have to do, right, Kate?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Usually it's women changing their name after a divorce.
Right. So we have to take a break here. But when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Kate Thayer, who's a features reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Kate has been reporting on this, by the way. We will tweet out her story so you can hear more about this. But we'll pick up this conversation on the other side of this short break. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. Chicago Tribune features reporter Kate Thayer is with us now. We're talking about a maybe not so well-known law in Illinois that in many cases women are required to do something that feels pretty old-fashioned, which is announce a name change to go back to their maiden name in the local newspaper after a divorce. Kate, you interviewed a woman named Stephanie Johnson for your story. How do women even learn that this is something that they have to do?
Well, in the case of Stephanie Johnson, she, you know, for whatever reason, didn't really think much about changing her name when she first got divorced. You know, she had young children. It just sort of wasn't on her radar. And then when she, a couple years later, went to go, you know, she got some documents from her local circuit clerk's office, to start the process to change her name back to her maiden name, which she felt like she wanted to do. She found that she had many steps involved, including this publication aspect, which she then sort of didn't want to do it.
Well, and she had to pay for that, you know, right? So including the legal process, you have to pay for these newspaper ads. So I imagine, did she end up doing this?
No, she told me that she still has, like, stacks of paper and, you know, that she could do it with these stacks of paper, but it's just kind of sitting on her desk collecting dust because it added, you know, time and money and a little bit of even, you know, a little bit of embarrassment on a process that already is lengthy. And something, a step that she didn't have to do when she got married, because that's not required for whatever reason by the law.
Oh, so when you get married, you don't have to do this. But if you get divorced, you do have to do this.
Your marriage license, correct.
And it sounds Kate, it sounds like Stephanie isn't the only one. I want to thank Tracy, one of our listeners on Twitter, says, I've been divorced for almost 2 years. There are still things that have my former combined last names on it. It's such a headache to change everything. Kate, there's actually a bill that passed in the General Assembly just this past session, sponsored by Democratic State Senator Christina Castro. Would it have removed all of these requirements?
Yes. So that's how I found out about this. I saw a tweet go out that just basically was sort of announced that Senator Castro's bill had passed both houses back when the legislature was wrapping up for their spring session. And I reached out to the senator and chatted with her about this. And sure enough, she decided to sponsor this legislation based on a friend, you know, going through divorce, who told her, you know, I didn't realize I have to do this to go back to my maiden name, and, you know, the whole privacy factor. So she decided to sponsor this bill. Sure enough, it passed, and it is sitting on the governor's desk.
Oh, so there may be a change to this soon if the governor signs it.
Yes, which she does expect he will sign it. It had, you know, no objection in either house. So she is expecting that this will eventually become law.
And a different process for divorced women in the state of Illinois. Kate Thayer is a features reporter with the Chicago Tribune. Kate, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Years ago, if you're interested in experiencing the most talked about art in the city of Chicago, you weren't going to the Art Institute or visiting a fancy gallery. You just had to walk around the Loop to see what the fuss was about. Because in the summer and fall of 1999, there were more than 330 different life-size fiberglass cow sculptures in the city. They were painted with different themes and colors, and the Cows on Parade exhibition was wildly successful. Back then, the cows weren't just a big deal for Chicago. They also changed public conversation worldwide about what public art could look like. Now, 20 years later, more than a dozen of those cows are back on the Magnificent Mile for the month of July. The original Cows on Parade exhibition was inspired by cow sculptures that Magnificent Mile shoe store owner Peter Hainig saw on his family vacation to Switzerland. Peter's in line with us now for more. Also joining us is Nathan Mason, who's the curator of exhibits and public art for the city of Chicago. And we're joined by Walt Chaddick, chair of the Public Art Committee for the Mag Mile Association in Chicago. Peter, Nathan, Walt, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Hey, howdy.
Peter, I wonder if we can start with you, and you can tell us how this trip to Switzerland sparked this idea to bring life-sized cow sculptures to Chicago city streets.
Well, it was me, my wife Alice, and my son Daniel. We decided to go to Switzerland for a vacation. We hiked in Zermatt. We went to Basel, Lausanne. Just had a wonderful time. And then we drove into Zurich. And as we're driving into Zurich, into the center, there are all these sculptures all over the place. And we spent about 3 or 4 days in Zurich just doing the sites. And the major site was all of these cows. Now, they had about 800 of them. And every place we went, people were gathered around. The sets were very interesting. There was one construction cow, I think, at the base of a dig for a sewer or something like that. So it was an unusual thing. And we were watching people's reactions. So we had a lot of fun just watching it, and I took a lot of pictures at that time.
And Peter, how did you think that people in Chicago would respond? Because when we go back to 1999, Chicago ended up having about 330 or so cows, right?
Yes. Yep. So, you know, so I had all these pictures. We came home. You know, I was looking at them, and I thought, well, maybe there's a connection here, you know, because certainly we are an agrarian state. We had the stockyards. We certainly had Mrs. O'Leary's cow. So it's a familiar object. When I was in school in Western Illinois, we would visit friends who had farms, and, you know, we would walk among the cows. They were very nice animals. And I thought, well, maybe something would work here. So I started approaching the Michigan Ammon Association at that time and started getting some really positive responses.
Nathan, I was actually at Northwestern when this exhibition started. It was right when I moved to Chicago, and I really remember this. I think in my head, it's one of those things that you remember, especially when you're in school, kind of your first introductions maybe to public art. And I wonder how successful the city of Chicago, when we say it was successful, how successful was it?
After the end of the project, the office had a survey done, and we determined that it generated an extra 2 million or more visitor days, which is a tourism metric that says people come and spend time specifically for a certain event. But we also know just anecdotally that it is one of the most popular things that we've ever done. And, you know, it was before the digital age, before photographs everywhere and Instagram, so it's hard to see, but now I think it would have been all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Walt, what do you think it did for the Magmile Association and for the stores and bringing people in 1999 down to Michigan Avenue?
Well, it certainly brought a lot of people down, as Nathan referenced. What it did was, you know, some people thought it might have been hokey. They thought the same thing about the bean, you know, in Millennium Park when that first arrived. But that's what beautiful art is about. It's a conversation. If you think it's hideous, some other person thinks it's magnificent. And that, I think, is what it lended itself to. Not only the Magnificent Mile, but all over the city. I mean, the original exhibit was, what, over 300 of the cows. So we have 20 at Jane Byrne Park right now, which is a lot less, but these are really remarkable looking in the landscape they're in now underneath the iconic water tower.
And so, Nathan, when we think about public art, I wonder how much you think, to Walt's point, this maybe shows people that art can be maybe attainable for people who aren't going to maybe go into a gallery or into a museum like the MCA or the Art Institute.
It is a good thing to put art out on the streets, and the cows were a very easy level of accessibility. Our goal, and we've done this, is to still elevate the level. You have to meet the public where they are, but there's also no reason not to ask the public to step up and think a little more. So trying to do more difficult or more
are that you have to think about before you immediately apprehend it is also a very good thing to do.
Nathan, there were also a couple of artists who contributed to this exhibition as students and are still a significant part of Chicago's art scene, right?
Yes, Edra Soto actually participated, and she is going to be one of the sculptors installing, just in a month or so, work in Millennium Park in the Boeing Galleries, which, you know, previously was occupied by Mark DeSouvreau and June Kaneko. So, yeah. And then others like Adam Brooks and Industry of the Ordinary had a cow. So there were some very, there were some artists who think very deeply about their artwork that managed to come into a theme project and transform it into something that is valid for them. But there are a lot of artists who participated who just did really lovely sort of decorative objects that the public could enjoy. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Peter, so you're actually loaning one of your cows to the Cows Come Home. That's what this summer's exhibition is called. Can you remind us what happened to the cows back in 1999?
Say that again. I missed that.
If you can remind us what happened to the cows back in 1999. There were 330 or so of them. What happened to them?
So what happened at the end, we made a decision that people could keep the cow, all the sponsors could keep their cows, or they could put it into an auction. We ended up having two auctions. We had an online, one of the early online auctions, and then we had a public auction at the Chicago Theater. And Nathan, you're going to have to check my numbers. I think we raised $1.4 million on the online and $1.8 in the Chicago Theater.
My understanding, it was about $3.5 million. Is that correct?
Yeah.
It was just under $3.5 million total between the two.
That went to charity then.
Right. And what we did was we let the sponsors decide which nonprofits they could give it to. So it could be Children's Memorial Hospital. It was Doctors Without Borders, Amnesty International. It was anything. And the response was way beyond. I think it was something like 10 times the estimate that we expected. And one of the cows went for $110,000, and the money went to, what was at that time, Children's Memorial Hospital.
Okay, now Larry. So, Walt, you mentioned it's the Cows Come Home exhibition is now in Jane Bergen Park. That's by Water Tower. There's 20 of the cows there now.
That's right. And it's such a different setting than their original placement. I mean, if you go down there, it's tranquil. You're on the Magnificent Mile, so there's a lot of hustle and bustle, but these cows are almost organically placed in this park. There's a lot of shrubs and greenery and flowers, and some are sitting and some are standing, and they're really neatly placed around this park.
Peter, I wonder what it means. We're almost out of time, but I just wanted to end by asking you what it means to you 20 years later to now see a smaller version of this come back. What are you hoping maybe a new generation of people visiting Chicago will get out of this?
Well, you know, I've spent some time in the park just watching people, and people approach it with a smile. Children especially look at it and are excited about it. I would guess that there are hundreds of thousands of photographs already taken now. So the response was very similar. It would have been nice to have more, but this is what we were able to do. And the response was interesting because, again, as Nathan said, it's approachable art, but it has some fun to it. It has some humor to it, and it has some interest to it. And I think regenerating that again is terrific. I think it's a lot of fun.
That's Peter Hoenig, who helped inspire this original Cows on Parade exhibition in Chicago in 1999. Now, 20 years later, they're bringing back a smaller version of this. As we're saying, if you're in the city, you could check it out. I want to thank Nathan Mason for being with us as well, curator of exhibits and public art at the City of Chicago, and Walt Chaddick, chair of the Public Art Committee with the Mag Mile Association. Gentlemen, thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye.
That's all the time we have for today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, ProPublica Illinois is reporting that sick children who've been separated from their parents at the border are being sent to Chicago shelters. And in some cases, these children have fevers, chickenpox, even tuberculosis. We're going to be speaking with ProPublica about what they're seeing. Our website, 21stshow.org, is a great place to go to get information about us, to find our handles on social media, to find past shows. You can also find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and NPR One. Search for The 21st. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.